Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.
What is Moondog?
Moondog Makers and Bakers is not just a catering company. It's blending tradition with innovation and something familiar just done differently. To get a taste of what they're truly all about, you can order some awesome merch, crafted spice blends, or request catering for your very own event. MoondogMakersandBakers.com.
This is Gerard Gibbert, and thank you for listening to Middays here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Get ready to go beyond the headlines and join a meaningful conversation with people from around the state. You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Everyone, and welcome to Midday Super Talk Mississippi. I'm your host, Gerard Gibbert, along with Will East, in for the vacationing rhino, kicking off a brand new week. We'll be guiding you through the middle of your day with facts, fodder, and fine music. Morning there, Will.
Morning. It's a beautiful day outside. It was a beautiful weekend.
Yes.
We almost had World War III, and it's tax day. So, you know, ups and downs.
This is one of those days where I feel like we need several hours to review all the activities across the country and honestly the planet as well. There's so much stuff going on. I wanted to start out by catching up on something I did not get to last week, and it was a text, a fascinating text from one of our listeners. And it concerns Cato Kaelin, of course, of O.J. Simpson fame. So last week, Will, I just talked about an interview I caught. I think it was Jesse Waters that interviewed him. And Cato Kaelin, the first thing I noticed is he doesn't look like he's changed a bit.
That guy, I saw a picture of him. He has not aged. And I was a kid when all this happened. He has not aged since then. Okay, was it 30 years ago?
Soon 94, be 30 years ago. 94, I think.
Yeah, so soon be 30 years ago. Not age one day. One day.
Incredible. Incredible. And he made a lot of sense in what he said. That was the main thing. But, so, we had this text on the C Spire text line. I'll read it to you. Gerard, I was roommates in a big house with Cato Kaelin in Hermosa Beach just prior to him moving into the alley apartment on the Simpson property.
Get out.
He's a good dude for sure. I was complimenting him and praising him last week because during the interview, he said some stuff that made a lot of sense to me. And the question that was asked was whether or not he thought racial relations had improved since then. And he basically said, talking about since the O.J. Simpson deal, which just looked like it had more of a racial overtone.
You've seen a lot of articles since O.J. passed away last week saying that was kind of the light on the fire of the kindling of that created the fire of all this race stuff that we have today.
Yeah, racial division, racial strife, the whole bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't see it, I don't think, then, where we are today.
And especially in the mass media.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. But, when you see then video, I remember it vividly, of the announcement of the verdict at the end of the trial and the reaction. And it's one of those things where it just seemed like across the board, all the black people were celebrating the verdict. And then you could just see a lot of white people. And I'm generalizing here. I'm just referring to what I saw on video.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of that's been replayed.
I remember they pulled us out of class to go into a room that had a TV.
Just to see that?
Just to see, and I can't remember what grade I was in when that happened, but they pulled us into a room, a big room, and had a TV up on the wall, you know, those old tube TVs, yeah. And everybody was in there, and they read the verdict. there was a reaction from some of the African-American people, you know, cheering, basically.
Exactly. I mean, exuberance. But you saw just people gathered in various settings, mainly white people, and maybe this was the media trying to foment racial division. I don't know, but mainly white people just shaking their head, couldn't believe it. You know, the verdict, and again, I'm generalizing, but it just seemed like it was a trial where it was more about this race versus that race than it was the facts of the case and whether or not a crime, in this case, murder, was committed. But this person goes on to say, we were roommates during the Rodney King riots. I believe that at least some of the racial tension that accompanied the O.J. trial was because of existing tension in the wake of R.K. This is from Geraldine in West Point, by the way. Cato roommate, in parentheses. So
that Rodney King thing was, maybe we didn't experience it as much here in Mississippi, obviously, but it was such a turbulent event.
Yeah.
And it was all on, here's the other thing, it's all on video.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know that we ever had anything like that before.
You had the video of the attack by the police officers on Rodney King, which was terrible. You had the video of them getting acquitted, basically.
Yeah.
And then you had the video of the riots that ensued and all the mayhem that went on there. And it was all, I remember President Bush at the time addressing the nation because of it. That's how big it was.
Well, just wanted to pass that on. I thought that was fascinating that we have someone in our audience, a resident here in Mississippi, that's
small world,
living around Cato. But what Cato went on to say about his opinion on racial division or harmony or just racial relations in the country was that he didn't think it had improved dramatically. And where he was going with that, and he kind of followed that up and said, you know, and he's obviously a lifelong resident of the Los Angeles area, still is, and he said, when you see people that are committing these blatant crimes where they're just stealing, pillaging stores, and hurting people with impunity. I mean, that's what he says. Mm-hmm. And his the word that he used, Will, was we lacked education. And I think what he was trying to say is that somehow, in many cases, the people committing these crimes have been convinced by certain people in our society, often in positions of leadership, that it's okay, it's justified, or that they lack just guidance and mentorship and development in the home, that they don't have figures in their life that teach them, no, that's wrong, you can't do that. So I think that's what he meant by education, which I thought was bravo for him. I thought it was spot on, and I think consistent with what a lot of us on the right think is that I certainly do, and I don't want to speak for everybody here, but the dissolution of the nuclear family is at the heart of almost all of our societal problems. And in fact, we no longer even hold it up as a standard or as the way to achieve the best societal outcomes and to develop young people into productive adults. They need a healthy and stable home life, and they need adult figures in their lives to teach them the difference between right and wrong. And I think that's what Cato was saying. We need some education. This isn't right. You just run around and just help yourself to other folks' property and hurt them. I shared last week, well, there's all kinds of recent incidents in New York, a video in particular that honestly hurt me just watching it. It disturbed me watching it. And it's an elderly lady that's stepping up, climbing a set of steps to go into her church on Sunday. And, of course, the church is located, you can tell, on a typical sort of building next to building street in New York. And it's got video cameras on the outside and that of course, have in view the steps and the platform and the front door. And out of nowhere, here comes this young thug that races up the steps, gets in front of her as she's just about to get to the top one, and just hits with like all his might, throws a fist right at her face, and she tumbles down the steps. And, of course, you could see her head popping on the concrete, clearly just passed out at that point, and he's just helping himself to her wallet or purse, whatever else he can find, and just takes off.
Oh, my gosh.
Going to church. So, and there have been some additional reports coming out of New York with this kind of stuff going on. But, again, based on what you're seeing with respect to DAs and the legal system in this country, probably gets off with nothing. And that's the problem. And there are many who would say, oh, he was justified in doing that because of, you know, some litany of social oppression that they'll use to rationalize.
Word systemic would be in there.
Right,
yeah.
Right, exactly. And I honestly, that's what Cato, I think, was trying to say in his own way. And I'm thinking, Cato Kaelin for governor of California. Well, we're going to step aside for a break. We're just getting started here on Middays. It's a two-hour show. Ricky Matthews, Super Talk Outdoors at 12:05. But at 11:05, you want to hear our interview with the commissioner of the Mississippi Insurance Department and also the state fire marshal, Mike Chaney. We're coming right back.
Ricky, don't lose that number.
Now back to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
We are back in the Element Well studio. So, just final comment on this. My belief, at least, that the dissolution of the nuclear family is a root cause of many of the problems in society, be it crime, drugs, economic challenges, all the above. And so... Not only, and by the way, statistically, it's irrefutable. The statistics showing the outcomes of those who were fortunate to be raised in a nuclear family versus those who were not cannot be denied. And that's not to say that a person, a child, who is not raised in a nuclear family, it's not to say that they can't have a positive, productive adult life. Not whatsoever. But statistically speaking, it's less likely. That's proven fact. But when you see, since this whole explosion of DEI and critical race theory that has occurred in the wake of the George Floyd ordeal, that often the tenets of that theory, of that ideology, which is fairly radical, include this idea that the nuclear family is a tenet of white supremacy. That's what bothers. Like, no, that's got nothing to do with race, honestly. It's irrelevant to race. It's just a principle. It's a concept, and it's fact. It's empirical fact that the likelihood of producing productive, stable adults from the rearing of children is just considerably higher when they are raised in a nuclear family. That's just fact, statistical fact. That cannot be refuted. But when you're pointing to that as something that you would term as bad, calling it white supremacy, Well, that just makes it even more difficult to solve real problems, honestly. Incredible. And we have a problem in the state of Mississippi. The last I checked, some 40% of the children in the state are being raised in homes without fathers. And again, certainly not saying that there aren't some really great single mothers that work their rears off and do everything they can to ensure that their child is stable, is loved, is productive, and then ends up being a productive contributor to society as an adult. Absolutely. And many of them will go out of their way to ensure there is some sort of father figure in their life as well, even though they may not live in a home with a father. And so my hat's off to those. But there, on the other hand, are many situations where that's not the case. And statistically, they got a tougher road to hoe. And that's, unfortunately, just a fact. But, again, we should not point to it as an element of white supremacy, which would be considered negative or a pejorative, if you will. But rather, we should focus on, well, how do we address this problem of fatherless homes, and not just included in this list of grievances and social inequities, which really isn't solving the problem, fundamental problem. But hats off to Cato. So it's tax day, as you mentioned earlier.
Tax day.
Oh, geez. And so the president, so you'll know, we'll have a lot to talk about certainly on Wednesday. He's headed to Scranton tomorrow. And guess what he's going to be talking about? Taxes. So what is that's what the content that is planned for his speech tomorrow. And, you know, if you think about tax day, and of course he's going to say the rich don't pay their fair share. When you think about tax day, from a political perspective, you have to consider the fact that there's a significant difference in opinion, I think is one way to put it, on how a President Biden or a President Trump would govern going forward. And I know I've said this many times before, and I apologize for being repetitive, but 2025 marks the end of the individual provisions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, a.k.a. the Trump tax cuts. Now, this is going to be front and center, I firmly believe, in Washington when we've got hopefully a new president. But, of course, we'll see the brand new House, all for 435, up for re-election, as is the case every 2 years, and about a third of the Senate up for re-election. And there's expected to be some flipping going on there. But this is going to be a controversial, a polarizing, I think a chaotic issue that lawmakers in Washington will debate. And I would love to see, and I think the American people deserve to see, a debate between the two presidential candidates, the two front runners that represent the parties. I'm not discounting other independents in the race, such as RFK, but I'd love to see these two debate. You could spend an hour just debating tax policy.
Could you imagine an hour of RFK speaking?
Oh, no. I couldn't deal with that. And I there's some things I agree with RFK, some things I don't. But I'd really like to see Joe Biden and Donald Trump debate tax policy. Now, it's unbelievable what some in the media say about all this stuff. You know, I've shared before the Boston Globe is, in my view, the most left-leaning major newspaper in the country. And they're blasting Trump because he won't release his tax returns, and they're praising Biden because he will. Oh, my gosh. And, of course, they're discussing the fact that Biden considers it a badge of honor that he was one of the known for many years as the poorest member of the Senate, if not the entire Congress, and that Trump inherited all his money and blah, blah, blah. They just get into all this class warfare stuff. And Trump says, look, the voters don't really have any need to see his tax data. I'll be honest with you, I don't care about these guys' tax returns. It doesn't matter to me. Now, if the IRS were to show up and say they cheated, yeah, that would matter. But to my knowledge, that hadn't happened.
Yeah.
So I don't really care.
I don't think there's anybody that's going to go, well, you know, I saw his taxes. I'm not going to vote for that person.
Right, exactly. It's irrelevant to me. I don't really care. I don't care how much money they made. I don't care how much taxes they gave. Now, you could perhaps find some hypocrisy when they try to hold themselves and promote themselves as these big champions of charity and stuff like that. And then you look at their tax returns, they don't give any money to charity. But really, that's very secondary to me. I don't really care. I care about where they stand on tax policy. And what I know is that Joe Biden has extremely aggressive plans to increase taxes. And I know that he said that he won't touch those whose income is below $400,000. And some people may say, well, that's why I support this president or the current president, because he ain't going to raise my taxes. He's only going to do one of those dirty, greedy, evil, rich people. No, that affects everybody. And that's often not seen. So you may have seen, Will, there's this on social media, there's this it's not really a meme. It's just it's a post where the words are accentuated. They're larger, and there's a colored black background. You know what I'm talking about, how you can do that on Facebook. And it says, Kroger's profit increased 35% from 2021. In case you're wondering who to be mad at about sky-high grocery bills. Well, as is always the case, and I say it's virtually always, it lacks fact, and it's not rooted, it lacks context, pardon me, and it's not rooted in fact. So I happened to do some research. I got curious about this. Is this really true? Well, it's a public company. Their financial statements are available online under EDGAR, the SEC's website. It's called EDGAR. I don't remember what it stands for, E-D-G-A-R. But I went and looked them up. And on the other side of the break, I'll share with you the truth about Kroger. And that's just one company they're attacking. They attack them all, but specifically with respect to groceries. Coming right back in the Element Well studio.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert, here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Did you play that because Donald Trump's going on trial today? For hush money paid to a porn star?
Well, it's very historic. At the same time, I thought he'd already gone, you know, the trial hadn't started, but it's been in the news so much, it's not really that, it is a big event, but I think we're kind of numb to it now. But I did read, I don't know, did you see this, Gerard?
What's that?
The questions they're asking the potential jurors.
Yeah, I did.
And one of them, everybody here would have to answer, do you listen to talk radio? That's one of the questions.
Huh.
They also asked them if they listen to podcasts. One of the other questions is, have you listened to a podcast that features Michael Cohen, Mark Pomerantz? If so, please let us know. And they list the podcast there. Do you have any ethical feelings about presidential contributions? Have you ever attended a rally or campaign event for any anti-Trump group
yep.
or organization?
Yeah.
Let's see. Have you ever attended a rally event for Donald Trump? Have you ever attended an anti-Donald Trump rally? Lots of things that they're asking them. The talk radio one I thought was funny because 99% of talk radio is conservative-leaning.
Yeah. Yep.
And the reason why that is because if you talk about something long enough, usually the conservative opinion wins. That's my opinion. But I found that interesting that they had that on the questionnaire for the jurors, the potential jurors.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, those dirty talk radio people. heaven forbid, we're influencing opinion. So here's the deal. I saw where in this particular district where these jurors will be selected, 87% cast their ballot for Joe Biden.
Yeah.
So I know that the judge is going to try, they're going to try to find, and of course the lawyers on both sides, they're going to try to find apolitical jurors, right, that don't have a political opinion and don't really have an opinion on Donald Trump. Where's that person on the planet?
It's going to be... It's impossible.
It's impossible. Impossible. So I would say on that basis and that he's not really going to get a trial where a decision is made by an impartial jury. I just don't see how.
You know, speaking, you mentioned earlier about O.J. Simpson. I remember watching or listening to an interview with one of the jurors in that case, and it was one of those cases where it was very difficult to find someone who wasn't familiar with the case because it had been in the news so much. But this lady was one of the true people who didn't know. She thought he was a basketball player, number one.
Okay.
And she didn't even know he was an actor. So she was like the one person. That was back in the days before the internet, before social media. You had maybe a few cable channels, but it was mostly, you know, your three big networks.
Yeah.
And they were able to find, you know, maybe one.
Sold.
Yeah.
You're in. Come
it's
on
It's impossible
in.
Nowadays. Who is sitting there going, wait, Donald Trump, is that the guy that, what was he doing? Did he run for president? Wasn't he a real estate guy? Wasn't he on TV? That person doesn't exist.
He, honestly, his home of New York is where he's least liked.
Yeah.
I mean, so not only is he in this big city of whatever it is, 8 million people, where he's not very popular, very highly thought of. But in this particular district, it's 87%. I just don't see how in the world you could choose an unbiased jury in that respect.
And he is the most polarizing, one way or the other, person maybe... I don't know, since Stalin, I don't know. I can't think of another person who one side loves him so much and one side hates him so much.
There's
no middle ground.
I think that is a function of a strong person who has very strong opinions and, for the most part, is very consistent in his opinion and promotes it, campaigns on it, advocates for his views a lot, very strongly. Just seems like, and the way he communicates it, I think, gets people that support him to be even more supportive. It endears him to them.
The never Trumpers are not called maybe Trump. They're
right.
called never.
Never Trump, yeah. And those who oppose him, they just get even stronger in their opposition every time he talks. So it's energizing one base and I guess, detracting another. I think it's one way to say it, and it very strong in a very strong way. It's unique. There's no doubt. I don't know that we've ever had a political figure like that.
He tried to get venue changes multiple times, and it just has not been able to.
And delay it.
Yeah.
And so this has to do with some payments to two individuals that so-called hush money, and it was about alleged affairs he had with them. And he paid them to stay quiet about it. But it's the way in which it was reported or not reported. I mean, that's not technically illegal, but the reporting of his campaign finances and his financial statements and so forth. That's really what they're honing in on. The essence of the case is whether or not there was some duplicity involved in that. I want to get back to this Kroger deal. So, by the way, I just saw on the television in the studio here him walking into court. Mm-hmm. It's a big deal. And I don't know if you saw, Will, over the weekend, the media lining up all the mobile vehicles, right, with all the mobile communications technology staged and ready to pounce on this thing and to broadcast it. It's going to be quite the spectacle before it's all over with. Let me get back to Kroger. So before we went to break, this post that's been viral the last couple of weeks, Kroger's profit increased 35% from 2021, in case you're wondering who to be mad at about sky-high grocery bills. And so this is the left's constant attack on corporate America and the people that sell the stuff we all buy, and everybody's frustrated with inflation, and they're looking for a bad guy, right? They're looking for a culprit. And in the case of the left, it's corporate America. It's the people that make stuff, sell stuff. They're the culprit. They're the cause of this crushing inflation. So I got curious. I went out to what's called EDGAR, which is just the SEC's site, if you will, Electronic Data Gathering Analysis and Retrieval System. I couldn't remember what the acronym stood for. But so you can go research and get all kinds of information, including official filings of public companies. They're called 10-Ks. 10-Ks are their annual filing package, financial statements, in the format that is prescribed by the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. 10-Qs are what they file on a quarterly basis. So I went and dug up their 10-Ks, and here's what I found. It is true what they said. Their operating profit did increase by 35% between 2021 and 2022. Absolutely true. However, in 2023, by the way, their fiscal year ends January 31. The operating profit for fiscal year 2023, which concluded just 2 months ago, it actually decreased from $3.1 billion from $4.1 billion in 2022, a decline of roughly 25%. Their profit went down. So they're telling you the 35% increase between 21 and 22, but they failed to mention between 22 and 23, it went down 25%. Up 35, down 25. That's just business. There's nothing unusual there. But here's the other thing that I think may shock some people. They don't make a whole lot of money. It's the grocery business. It's extremely thin margins. We all know that. So their gross revenue sales is $150 billion. So they made $3 billion of net operating profit on $150 billion. That's 2%. 2%. So let's take all their profit. Just wipe it out. You make no profit. And you plow that back into price cuts. You just forego your profit, but instead of making a profit, you either don't raise prices or perhaps you lower them year over year and pass that on to the consumer. That means your prices go down 2%. Well, inflation's up 20% since Biden took office. Heck, on some grocery items, it's up a whole lot more than that. But in general, the average of grocery inflation, most economists place it about 20%. So you'd get 2%. You need 20%. It's up 20%. But let's go even further. You make no profit. There ain't no company. And 430,000 people, that's how many work for Kroger, they got no job. They just fail to recognize those little details. Unbelievable. Well, we're stepping aside for a break in the Element Well studio. It's Commissioner of Insurance Mike Chaney coming up at 11:05. Stay with us.
Selling your vehicle.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
back in the Element Well studio, CC in Senatobia. We were reminiscing a bit about the O.J. Simpson trial. He says the entire reality of two slaughtered humans was devoid in the minds of the black community when the O.J. verdict was read. It was 100% black defeated white. And that's what's disturbing, Will, is just the way in which, I guess, just facts and principles and morals and concepts just get tossed out the window, and everything is just focused on, as CC says here, racial division and pitting one against another. And if you think about what's at the heart of all this CRT ideology and all this DEI stuff, it really tends to foment those attitudes and those sentiments. It's just the opposite of what we should be doing, which is working to achieve more harmony in this country. And I personally think we've come a long dang way. You just look right here in our home state, and we're often held, certainly outside of our state, across the rest of the country, as the one where more racism exists than in any. And I submit that, in fact, though we have work to do, of course we do. We're flawed humans, that we have more racial harmony here than most, if not all, the other states. And to a great extent, that's because there is a small difference, a small margin between the races that comprise our total population. We had to figure out a way to get along, honestly. Otherwise, I'm not sure we would have survived. I think we just figured out we got to overcome these differences and live with each other and respect the dignity of each other in the life. And I know I've talked about it before, but heck, there are a lot of neighborhoods. You know this, Will. There are a lot of housing developments in other parts of the country that are strictly one race or another.
Absolutely.
In the blue states, where they constantly point fingers and condemn a state such as Mississippi as still harboring racism. You go up to Westchester, New York, you don't see the races mixed among the homeowners in a given development. Where here, we don't even think about that. It doesn't enter anybody's mind. And, you know, we carry on our lives. We don't think about the fact that everywhere we go, we see diversity, do we not, in race? You can't go anywhere that I'm aware of in this state and just associate with those who look like you. And that's not a bad thing. I'm just saying that, and nothing happens. And I see people respecting each other and being courteous and kind to each other. Every day you see examples of it. That never gets highlighted, does it? We never talk about those kind of small victories, as I call them. No. All the focus is on the one negative out of 1,000 positives. The left just runs with it. Jackpot, we got it. Gotcha. We told you. And again, I'm not saying that it doesn't exist. Of course it does. Again, we're flawed humans. We're sinners. We acknowledge that. But, man, we've come a long dang way, have we not? We've got to take some stock of that and recognize that. And, again, I freely admit we got more work to do. But we get misrepresented a lot, more than we get accurately represented. I'm talking about the great state of Mississippi. And it's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Just where we are here. I mean, you can't go anywhere without seeing. But I can tell you, you can go to some parts of the country. I spent a lot of time in Denver. No disrespect to Denver. You can spend days in Denver and never see a black person. It's not a good or a bad thing. It's just fact, reality. So how do you know that they have achieved some degree of racial harmony? You hadn't had to achieve any. We did, just because of the composition of our population. We had to figure it out. I'm not sure we would have survived, honestly, as a state. But I think that has to be considered. But yet we get lectured, do we not?
Absolutely.
By the liberal white elitists in the coastal states. They don't have to deal with this the way we do. I deal with it, I mean have to deal with. We got to figure out how to live with each other. You can't just isolate yourself and escape it. That's not a bad thing. I'm saying, yeah, that's fine. We're cool with that. We figured it out. Why don't we ever? Why don't they ever acknowledge that? I have entertained people that have come from other states that have never been here before in my business career. They're blown away. It's nothing like what
it's
they...
It's the most diverse state.
No doubt about it. They cannot fathom what they saw. They were just blown away. In a positive way. In a very positive way. Couldn't believe it. Man, we are in the Element Well studio. We're stepping aside for Fox News and Super Talk News. That's because it's top of the hour. When we return, it's the Commissioner of Insurance, Mike Chaney. Stay with us.
Get ready to go beyond the headlines and join a meaningful conversation with people from around the state. You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. Hour two of Middays is live in the Element Well studio. We appreciate you joining us today. Are you thinking about or planning for a retirement? Do you have a plan? Go to myelementwealth.com or call 601-957-6006 to let Element Wealth help you find your balance between income growth and guarantees. 601-879-4395. That would be the C Spire text line. Please do not text and drive. So, yep, once again, it is tax day. As I see the commissioner arriving here in the studio, but wanted to pass this on to you. There is a popular school of thought, of course, that the wealthy just don't pay their fair share, right? Well, we've been through these statistics before, but I think on tax day it's appropriate to review them again. The top 1% account for 23% of the total adjusted gross income in this country. However, they pay 46% of the taxes. The top 1% pay more total taxes than the bottom 90%. The top 50% pay 97.5% of total income taxes. The bottom 50% account for 2.5%. Half the household in this country paid no federal income taxes, but that to the left in this country is unfair. I agree. It is unfair. I wish I just paid my fair share, if you want to know the truth. But we welcome now to the Element Well studio Mike Chaney, the commissioner of the Mississippi Insurance Department, also serves as the state's fire marshal. Commissioner, good to see you, sir. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Gerard. Speaking of taxes, I had to pay my fair share Friday, and I'm not a happy camper. I talked to my insurance chair, and he said, "I just filed my taxes." And I said, "Yeah, and I'm going on Gerard's show to talk about how you go spend it, I guess."
I mean, it truly is crazy. It's so lopsided in one direction, but that's a discussion for another day. But it's these kinds of facts, though, as you know, Commissioner, that don't often get enumerated in the public, and the president's going to be in Scranton, Pennsylvania tomorrow talking about how we need to pay even more. It's never enough, is it? But we thank you for coming in. So the something that's going on down there at the legislature that you have weighed in on with support is the possibility of the state of Mississippi taking control and responsibility for operation of the ACA exchanges, also sometimes called marketplaces. These, of course, are online portals, if you will, where folks can go out and purchase insurance in the individual market. And this has been around for a long time. Initially, as you know, Commissioner, the original law would have required every state to set up and operate its own exchange. But the Supreme Court ruling included a provision that said, no, federal government, you can't do that. So most states said, okay, we'll let the federal government handle that. In the state of Mississippi, we had actually planned to create, as I recall, our own exchange and decided not to. And the federal government said, no, we'll do that because it's quite expensive. And it's onerous.
Yeah, the background on the state-based exchanges from Mississippi go back to Haley Barbour. When Haley was governor, he was for an exchange-type program. He understood it. And when I became commissioner, he had his staff work with us very closely about developing a state-based exchange. We actually worked with the former head of HHS out of Utah, and we had a pretty good plan, but the long and short of it is the feds did not approve us operating a state-based exchange. But the plan that we developed with federal money was sent to New Mexico, Arkansas, Idaho. Several states have the same plan. Kentucky used it.
Okay.
And Arkansas uses a bifurcated plan, which was an alternate plan we had where you take Medicaid dollars and buy actual bona fide insurance policies on the exchange. That's what Arkansas does.
Yep.
So you've got three types. You've got a state-based exchange operated totally by the state. You've got a state-based exchange that operates off the federal platform, which simply means we're using their software. Everybody does, but they hold your hand for a while.
Yeah.
And then you've got a federally facilitated marketplace, which we have here in the state of Mississippi. It means it's run 100% by the feds. My job as insurance commissioner is to be certain that we have qualified health plans on that program. I do approve the rates for what they charge. We approve them within a narrow framework based on medical loss ratios, a lot of the analytical statistics, and we have to argue with the feds that sometimes the feds want them to charge more, we want them to charge less. So anyway, it's a program that's good. And so anybody that gets on the federally marketplace, facilitated marketplace, or the state-based exchange gets something called federal tax credits. So it's appropriate to understand federal tax credits since everybody's paying income tax
yep.
today. And the federal tax credits are very lucrative. They go from the federal government to the insurance carrier on a quarterly basis. So somebody between 100 and 150% of the property level, and that's $15,000 at 100%, gets the subsidy of a tax credit, and they end up paying somewhere close to $30. That's an average per month for health insurance. The criticism has been from most folks is, well, the out-of-pocket's $5,000 on a silver plan, got a 20% copay. And I said, guess what? I got a 20% copay on my own insurance. I have out-of-pocket expenses, too. But we have something called cost share reductions where the federal government gives the five people that own the exchange, the five companies, a subsidy to reduce those costs for the people between 100 and 150% of property level. And that gets into a whole other network. If you want to talk about it, I will, about Medicaid expansion. I'm against Medicaid expansion under the House plan and under the state plan. Just make that out there. Throw it out.
The Senate plan, too? I'm sorry. You said
the state plan and the Senate plan needs some work done to it because you've got to have a lot of other issues have to fall into place before you have the Senate plan.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. But one thing I wanted to go back. So thanks for that overview, that explanation. $30. So under the American Rescue Plan, the range of income between 100%, pardon me, and 150% is advertised at 0% premium. So 2% was the old model. The subsidies were based on limiting premiums to 2% of household income. Since ARPA was passed in 2021, it's supposed to be zero. So I'm curious as to how they would have any premium costs whatsoever. The out-of-pocket costs I totally get, and you're right, the cost-sharing reductions also offset that rather considerably. In that income range, 100 to 150, we talk about that mainly because that also conflicts, in my view, with Medicaid. There's overlap there. And that could put your out-of-pocket costs, depending on the plan you select, somewhere between, $100 a year to $1,800 a year, something like that.
pretty close to it.
Yeah.
So the way this works is the federal government gives you a subsidy.
Yeah.
The insurance company has to verify, or the consumer verifies that my pay that I make is $15,000 or more. You're above the property level.
Yep.
Otherwise, you can't buy on the exchange.
That's right.
So what the feds want to do on Medicaid expansion is come in and take 140,000 plus people that are on our exchange in Mississippi that are paying a premium and move them over to give them free insurance.
Well, I'm not sure how they're paying a premium. If they're on the benchmark silver plan, it's supposed to be zero. I mean, it's zero, 30 bucks a month. It's not that much money, no matter what. Yeah. So it's kind of irrelevant in that.
So my logic with them, I said, why would you do that? And they said, well, we don't want them to pay any out-of-pocket costs. And I said, well, subsidize that. Don't kill the exchange. If you take them off and put them on Medicaid, there's a point of diminishing returns where you can't operate the exchange.
Yeah.
And you just destroyed something that's working. So when you look at the hospital groups and all the physicians that want to expand Medicaid, that's much to do about nothing. We wouldn't add 30,000 people to the Medicaid rolls if we expanded it today.
You wouldn't add 30,000.
That's
so
right.
So where do you come up with that?
Pretty simple. The feds say the number is about 77,000. Kaiser Family Foundation says 75,000 to 80,000.
Wait. Of income between what and what?
Between 23% of property and 100% of property level.
Okay. The so-called coverage gap.
Coverage gap. So when you look at the take-up on coverage gap in other states like Kentucky, Georgia's trying to do an exchange, the take-up rate's about 30%.
Yep.
And when you do the numbers, the real numbers are about 25,000 to 30,000 people.
Last data I looked at from Georgia, whose plan is very similar to the Senate's plan, 3,500 have signed up. They expected 300,000.
And they passed, and they spent $26 million.
A year.
That's
what they're saying, a year. And most of that, they said, is going to Deloitte.
It's bad dollars.
It's actually costing. I mean, we think $26 million for 3,500 people. So I'm with you on that. We got Commissioner Mike Chaney in the Element Well studio. We're coming right back.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Let's do this.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
Let's go.
Back in the Element Well studio with the Commissioner of Mississippi Insurance Department, Mike Chaney. So, all right, so I'm with you. So the Senate says let's just go to 100% of the federal poverty level. The House says no, let's go to the full 138. I still think we have this overlap, and I've always felt like, Commissioner, that there's like a drafting error on the part of the feds. Like, why would you make this same income group eligible for Medicaid on the one hand, but also eligible for subsidized premiums in the exchanges, but yet you're going to put them in Medicaid? And so another question I have is, why in the expansion states is there anybody signed up in the exchanges in those income ranges if the federal government, through the IRS, is actually supposed to say, no, you're not eligible for these premium subsidies. You're supposed to be in Medicaid. But that's not what they're doing. Is it just incompetence on their part? Or why was anybody signed up?
Well, we can't figure out why the CMS wants to put everybody on Medicaid. I did argue this with the top six people at Medicaid several weeks ago that you're better off to leave them on the exchange because the insurance companies pay a better rate to the health care provider, the doctor, the hospital. And actually, it gets complicated here, and they cannot give you a reason.
They don't know.
They don't know. And I did tell them, I said, you better be glad I'm not in charge. I'd sue you in the morning. I've sued you over the feds, and I'll win because we know the law.
There's overlap, and I don't know if that was intentional or not. It's like overlap, but it's wink, wink. We're going to move, even though you're eligible, we're going to move you into this program. You got sort of these options.
Yeah.
But then we have a lot of people that are signed up in the exchanges. And I agree that providers I've talked to have all said that, sure, you're going to get higher reimbursement. I mean, that's standard in commercial coverage reimbursement versus Medicaid and Medicare, for that matter. They've all told me the exception is there's some rural health care facilities where it's actually better under Medicaid than it is with commercial coverage. There's federal incentives for that.
Well, there is an incentive on rural facilities to get a little more pay. And I think Drew Snyder, the head of Medicaid, and the governor have done a good job of trying to get that approved.
Absolutely.
I will tell you that three or four weeks ago, the feds had told us they weren't going to approve the second part of the governor's plan. But after we talked to them,
they did.
We did get a call, and they said, oh, we're probably going to approve it because that's one way to get the money where we want it to go.
$150 million a year.
Yep,
yeah,
that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I agree.
And I commend the governor for his efforts and Drew Snyder for what they've done.
So I want to point this out. And no disrespect whatsoever to Senator Blackwell, who heads the Medicaid committee over there in the Senate. He's made the statement that their plan is not, quote, Obamacare expansion. That's not true. That able-bodied coverage in Medicaid to able-bodied adults in the coverage gap up to 100% of the federal poverty level is only available because of the Affordable Care Act. That was not available. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with it.
And that's Obamacare really, expansion.
When you talk about straight expansion, that would be Lyndon Johnson's plan because, you know, in 1965, that's when we got Medicare, Medicaid, and all the other things that went with it. And it's been complicated since then. But the bottom line is, as a way to do this, to cover these folks without the state having to put an arm and a leg out, you and I discussed very briefly off air that if we did straight Medicaid expansion, it's 77-23 split, and put 25,000, you could cap it without the feds. They have to approve the expansion.
Yep.
You would put about 25,000 people on the exchange. We're going to pick up $36 million in new tax revenue off of the expansion on the state-based exchange and the federal facilitated exchange in the state of Mississippi on $1.2 billion. That's $36 million. Expanding to 25,000 people on Medicaid would cost the state $1,700 a person, about $45 million in round numbers. And if you use the $36 million to reduce the 45 or 46, you only got to come up with $10 or $12 million.
Yeah.
That's and the way the legislature operates, that's chunk change for them.
So the states also, we should point out, you're paying fees to the federal government, right, to operate the exchange.
You do, and the way that works, the government gives you the fee, and then you turn around and give the fee back. I call it smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
I told the Senate Finance Committee last week I call it smoke and mirrors, but they pay a fee of 3.5%, and then you pay it right back to the federal government. Under a state-based system, the federal government would still get their share, but we would get 2.5 to 2%, depending on which year of operation, if you had a state-based exchange. So sticking to that subject, I told the Finance Committee, I said, it's a good tool to have in your quiver, in any tool shed, to have a state-based exchange, but I would definitely not try to operate one without approval of the governor and to make certain we had all the plans in place. And we gave them a timeline. We could operate one within 6 months, but you want to know what the administration is going to be before you get into this. And we're probably going to have a new president in January of next year. And I would point out, if you look at the vote in the Senate to send the exchange, state-based exchange, back to the House, all Democrats voted against it, and two Republicans. I think the two Republicans were misguided.
Okay,
but it passed.
Okay,
it's going to the House.
So what would result, if I understand this correctly, just the process and the mechanics of the system, is that we would get sort of a rebate on some of the user fees, which is to offset the cost of operating it. And I believe you made the statement that would more than cover our cost of operating a state-based exchange, and thus we would net in the positive. Is that correct?
That's correct. We'd pick up anywhere from $25-35 million a year.
Okay. And I think it's also fair to say, Commissioner, that the technology's come a long way since it was.
It really
because
has.
You remember states were spending hundreds of millions to create these online systems, and many were failing, honestly. We've come a long way, and the models are out there. The blueprints are out there for this, so we're not reinventing the wheel here.
It's off-the-shelf technology. Kentucky's been very successful operating an exchange. Virginia has. They're all within our realm here. Arkansas has been successful. They've changed theirs a little bit, but they've been successful. Now Georgia's trying to get into the act. The feds are a stumbling block for Georgia. John King's a personal friend. He's the commissioner there. And he and the governor just trying to – they have to fight with the federal government all the time. I will tell you that a state-based exchange would really benefit the state. And I did tell the committee, I didn't lobby for this. This is something – I didn't even know about it until 4 hours before they passed the bill. So.
Yeah. I agree. I think it would, too. So
it'll help.
One of the concerns has always been that the carriers we have, which sell coverage in the exchanges, have been, I don't know how I would term it, but maybe kind of second tier relative to, we have one major carrier, right, that has by far the most robust network and accounts for the vast majority of the coverage in the state, which is typical in almost every state, but is more focused on group coverage than individual coverage.
Well, that particular company, out of the 250,000 max policies that they actually write, 200,000 of them are group.
Yeah.
Large and small group.
Means they're selling insurance to employers, whereas the exchanges are designed for folks who buy insurance in the individual market.
But now let me say that company you mentioned, they control 750,000 other policies through what we call a TPA arrangement. That's a third-party administrator. And we do have a bill that's gone to the governor that would say that if you're a policyholder and you live in Mississippi, and that policy was issued in Tennessee or Alabama, that you have the right to those benefits because you paid a premium for them,
sure,
administered in Tennessee and Alabama. And I had a case 3 weeks ago where the difference was $10,000 on a drug that Alabama had approved. And the doctor had called Alabama's Blue Cross. They said, yeah, it's approved. And then when they administered the drug, the TPA here in the state said, nope, we're going to administer it at $10,000 less than what it is, a life-saving deal. I think I got that solved last week, but I hadn't talked to my staff this morning.
So you've also explained to me that premiums administered through the TPA program or that arrangement are not subject to the medical loss ratio.
They aren't, and that's what we couldn't get our hands around, and we tried to pass a bill last year to let us look at it through the Examination Act. Got vetoed, but we've got around it another way through NEIC, and I said, okay, if that's the way you want it, we'll just fix it to where the companies are going to have to file with us what that consumer paid for. This is a bill of rights for consumers. It's a contract. If you buy something and you expect something in return and find out, oh, by the way, we're going to modify your contract without you knowing about
it. Sure. And, yeah, that's so.
And it's not about medical. It's about drug costs.
No doubt. And that's a loophole. I think that was a drafting error, honestly, where TPA services aren't subject to the medical loss ratio. For the benefit of our audience, folks, that simply means that since the Affordable Care Act was passed, it was a provision of it that 80% of the premium revenue taken in by an insurance carrier must be paid out in claims, and if they don't, they got to rebate those to the difference to their subscribers.
Or 85 if you're big. Now, put in the bill. I asked Lee Yancey and Walter to put in the bill. We exempted ERISA plans, those plans that the federal government runs, and self-funded plans. So it doesn't affect Amazon any of the other big folks.
Yeah.
Actually, the biggest complaints are from 65,000 federal workers and the law firms that have their base in
Nashville
and Birmingham. They don't want me to talk about that, so it is what it is.
Commissioner, appreciate you coming in. Always good to see you, sir.
Always
thanks.
A pleasure.
You bet.
Thank you, Gerard. Appreciate what you do.
Thank you, man. Coming right back in the Element Well studio.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
It is on.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
Saturday night, I was downtown.
are back in the Element Well studio. Okay, so I want you guys to know that Mr. Cheney literally just walked out. He and I had a very good discussion, follow-up. And you know, well, that happens a lot. Once we conduct interviews, we'll often just have very frank and open discussions. Sometimes it's off the record, as you know, and we'll both say that, okay, it's in for public knowledge, in for air, and that's fine. And I'm happy we have that kind of relationship with so many people that come here. But as you know, this is the value of folks coming in the studio. It's I'm telling you, more happens in the breaks, right,
yeah,
in these discussions, often than it is on the air.
You learn things. By talking to people,
yes,
you learn things.
Yes, absolutely. And so Mike and I just had, the commissioner, a really good discussion about this. And on the ceasefire text line, Mondays are hard enough. We only got 2 hours. And I agree, we got a lot to talk about, but we'll be back on it again tomorrow. So I truly do think, I just want to follow up on this, that was there a drafting error here? Because, and what I mean by that is, you got two programs that cover folks with the same qualifications. It's never made any sense to me. Since 2010, when the thing was passed, I scratched my head and said, wait, there's overlap here. And especially now with the enhanced subsidies in the exchanges that came about when the American Rescue Plan was enacted in 2021, such that the subsidy model shifted up, meaning that lower costs of coverage from the income starting at 100% all the way up to 400%. So, and what that did is rendered the 100 to 150 at zero cost premiums, or virtually zero cost, for the benchmark silver plan. It's like, well, that's essentially the equivalent to Medicaid, because Medicaid's free. And when I started talking to many legislators about this, you remember, Will, this goes back 3 years ago when the thing passed. Why aren't we all over this? Why aren't we leveraging this in lieu of Medicaid expansion? And the response I often got was, well, I didn't know anything about that. They literally didn't. Didn't know anything about that. Wait, this is a major federal law just passed. And I'm not sure what sort of communication exists between our federal delegation and our state lawmakers, but I would encourage them to talk more. Because when you get, even if you didn't support, by the way, not a single Republican supported the American Rescue Plan, now we got folks down there at the Capitol that are bragging about leveraging it. Think about that. Have you seen any city, any county, or the state refuse all the money that was showered upon us?
Absolutely not.
No. In fact, many of them are bragging about it. They're bragging about something they disagree with. I consider that inconsistent. I don't blame them for taking the money. I'm not criticizing them for that. Sure, you mean if you can use that money to improve, and there's limits on what you could use it for, your water infrastructure, and to some extent, I think it may have been limited to almost just that, if I'm not mistaken, for cities. But there was a list of qualified uses, and sure, of course you're going to take that money. But you know, something that really bothers me when you think about leveraging the exchanges, which I'm all for, and I know that's what the Senate plan contemplates, the House's plan doesn't. It would overlap, and the fear is, of course, that, well, the federal government tries to direct those people into Medicaid. Now, this is the point that's not getting talked about. That actually cost more. Here's what I mean by that. So you look at the Senate's plan, and the Senate will tell you, no disrespect to the senators, hey, look, this is more conservative. You've heard that. It's more conservative because it only covers those whose income is below 100% of the federal poverty level. So that essentially means the first comment I'd make is, okay, so you're not for welfare, except if it's just this much welfare. Like, we're putting a dollar amount on it. Well, if it's just this much, that's not really welfare. But if it goes above that, that's welfare. I can't support that. No, it's still welfare. And the other point is, Okay, well, if the theory, and I'm not arguing with what the commissioner said and what the Senate is proposed, the theory being, well, just let those people at 100 to 138%, rather than expanding Medicaid to that level, let them obtain coverage on the exchanges. It's virtually free. It's almost as where Medicaid is, which is free. I agree. Makes sense. And the argument is, well, the federal government pays for all of that. State doesn't have a cost. Well, guess what? Where does the federal government get their money? The same people who are paying taxes in Mississippi. Yeah. And in fact, if you filed your tax returns today, go look at them, folks. Who are you paying more to? The federal government or the state? Rhetorical question. Way more to the federal government. So the idea that, oh, that doesn't cost anything. Yeah, it does. It's still welfare. You're still paying for it in your taxes. It's just we've got this situation where, well, it doesn't cost anything if it comes from the federal government. You know that's a prevailing attitude. Well, that doesn't cost anything. The Fed covers that. You hear that all the time. Well, the Fed covers. It was Fed grants. It was Fed this. Who do you think pays for that? And guess how we got $34 trillion in debt? Oh, well, the Fed pays for that. Don't worry about it. Next thing you know, it's $34 trillion in debt.
Spending more on interest payments than we do the military.
A trillion is scheduled for this year. The military is about $850 billion. That's where we are. It's insane. Okay, so this is the other thing is, it's actually more expensive because the subsidies that cover coverage in the exchanges cost more than Medicaid. And that's one of the reasons the government directs people, the federal government, from it when they expand Medicaid fully from the exchanges to Medicaid, because it actually costs less. Doesn't cost the state less. It costs the Fed less. But guess who pays the Fed? You see what I'm trying to explain here? It actually costs more money overall. But because we segregate the pots of money, we parse those out, state money, federal money. Oh, it's federal money. We don't care about that. And the same, honestly, is true when we expand Medicaid fully to 138%. Well, the federal government pays 90% of that. Well, who the hell you think the federal government is? So I'm a taxpayer. Oh, well, I only got to pay for 10%. No, you got to pay the other 92%. It's just that it comes from the Fed. Oh, if it's coming from the Fed, that doesn't cost anything. Yeah, it does. Oh, my gosh. You see how we got $34 trillion in debt? Because the Fed's got an unlimited printing press. And you want to know why the cost of stuff's high at Kroger? It ain't because of Kroger's profit, like we talked about earlier. It's because of that printing press. Mm-hmm. We now also... To the left who thinks we don't pay enough taxes, I want to share this tidbit with you. Under the Trump tax cuts, revenues first have risen. The amount of revenue produced by the federal government last year was sufficient to cover spending in 2019, pre-pandemic. If we return to 2019 spending levels, we balance the budget. That's a true story. Go look it up, folks. 2019. However, because of our irresponsible, mindless spending, we're at $6.3 trillion. We were at $4.3 5 years ago. It's increased 50% in 5 years. Now, granted, the vast majority of that is Social Security, it's Medicare, it's Medicaid, it's interest payments because of all the money we printed during the COVID era, including in 2020, Donald Trump's final year, and it's all the other federal assistance programs. I know there's a lot of people out there that think, oh, it's Ukraine. I oppose all the crazy money we're sending to Ukraine, but it is less than a drop in the bucket in the scheme of things. It's not the reason spending went up $2 trillion, or the deficit is now at $2 trillion, and spending went up as well, $2 trillion. It's up 50%. That is driven by the substantial increases in Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, other federal assistance, and debt interest, the result of all the helicopter money we printed in 2021. Trump left office, we were sitting at about $26-27 trillion in debt. When he got into office, we were under 20. But he was doing, honestly, Mr. Trump, in deference to him, respect to him, his circle of advisors, Republicans, so-called conservatives, were telling him, we got to shut the economy down and send all this money out. The CARES Act, who could forget that monstrosity? $3 trillion. Between that and the other $900 billion bill, and everybody got these stimulus checks and the PPP loans and all that stuff. Who could forget that? Wasn't that long ago. That's how we got $34 trillion in debt. But this idea that, oh, we just leave people on the exchanges, the federal exchanges, that we're about to operate in, internally as a state. I agree with the commissioner. I think we should go in that direction. By the way, I want to point out, this has been available since 2014. This ain't anything new. This has been available for 10 years. And I know the commissioner's pushed it. It's like the legislators waking up saying, well, maybe this is a good idea. We're coming right back. Final segment in the Element Well studio.
I'm a mom who...
Are we going to do this?
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Keep rolling. 3, 2, 1.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me.
Boy, if that ain't ever appropriate. The Fab Four tax man. So, there are a lot of folks that really don't pay a lot of attention to the tax code, and honestly shouldn't have to. It's ridiculously complex. We've made it that way, and a lot of folks don't really understand a lot of the mechanics of taxes. There are lots of myths, if you will, about taxes, this being tax day. Appropriate to talk about that, such as the one the president and the left like to promote, that the rich just don't pay any taxes. And we've obviously explained that to the cows come home. 46% of the taxes are paid by the top 1%, though they only account for 21% of the total income. So, and there was a question on the ceasefire text line. So half don't pay taxes. It's true. Half of the households in this country do not pay any federal income taxes. But the average return per American is $3,000. Well, that's just taking the, makes no sense. It does. I mean, that's just taking the total amount of adjusted gross income subject to income tax and dividing it by the total number of taxpayers. That's all that is. So that would still yield a figure. I don't know. I hadn't looked at it. If it's $3,000 is right or not, that's a metric I haven't measured. That doesn't mean that everybody, the average doesn't mean everybody paid that much. It just means that's the average. You can pay zero and still be figured into the average. So if the total amount paid, for example, were $1,000 and there are two taxpayers, that's $500 per taxpayer, but only one actually paid. I mean, that works. That's the way averages work. Also called the mean. Versus the median. Median means half or on this side and half on the other side. Mean means the average.
Is this the first tax day since Biden expanded the IRS?
I think it is. And there's a good little point there that reports are showing that most of the audits are being triggered for people who make less than $200,000. Remember, this was all about going after the rich who don't pay their fair share.
Yeah, I'm looking at the official press release by the IRS. IRS announces sweeping effort to restore fairness
Oh, yeah.
To
right. Restore fairness.
The tax system. With the, of course, this was the Inflation Reduction Act.
Right. Exactly. Thomas says, it's likely a bait and switch. Get them on the exchange, then roll them into socialized medicine. Hey, Thomas, the exchanges are run by the government. They are funded by the government. The government is what equates to socialize. It's all government. So is Medicare. Government. You see, between Medicare, Medicaid, and those in the, on the exchanges, that's about 175 million of the total 300 million with insurance. It already is socialized. What are you talking about, man? According to your definition, which is government has any involvement in it. And so is private coverage. It is highly regulated. We just had the insurance commissioner on the program. Guess what he does? Regulates insurance. That's government. Man, oh man. This is standard operating procedure for the government, says Dave, talking about this overlap between Medicaid and the federally subsidized exchanges. How many other programs are duplicated in various different agencies? We have so much money that we waste by duplicating services. Yeah, it's a little different here, Dave, because we're not paying twice. The taxpayers are either funding Medicaid coverage or they're funding subsidies in the exchanges. But I hear what you're saying. No, there's no doubt. There's lots of fat that could be taken out and just purged from government, no doubt, extracted out. Absolutely. I've always advocated for some sort of analysis to be commissioned. You'd love to see it commissioned by the president, who has broad control over the agency complex. Just investigate all this kind of nonsense and see where we could cut. I mean, let's start with that. That's easy. That's a softball. I'm all for it. The CBO estimates that there's some $270 billion of so-called improper payments throughout these programs, most of which occur in Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Improper payments. Just fix that to start with. $280 billion. Folks, we're out of time here today. We thank you so much for joining us. We are back again with you tomorrow in the Element Well studio. Until then, stay safe and God bless.
Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.